This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the uavdigest.com/GoEngineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. And by Unmanned Systems and Solutions, USAS, a combat veteran-owned company that repairs all types of drones. If you're a consumer who owns a drone, a small business using drones, or a drone manufacturer looking for sophisticated repair, distribution, and warehousing, look into USAS. For more information, visit unmannedsas.com/UAV Digest. You're listening to episode 190 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, looks like we got to do another show, and we've got a little different than normal, huh?
Yes, we do. We have an interview that our good friend Tim Trott, the drone professor, provided with us. He actually recorded this at Sun and Fun in Lakeland, Florida, and he talks to Ryan Reed of UAvionics about ADS-B and using that technology on drones. So we've got that coming up.
And of course, we've got some news stories. We've got drone racing, the FAA's faster, and the Border Patrol wants facial recognition. So I guess we should roll that Tim Trott footage.
I'm talking to UAvionics, Ryan, and introduce yourself.
I'm Ryan Reed. I handle communications and customer support for UAvionics.
What's on the radar, bad pun, coming down the line with regards to ADS-B and drones and awareness?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about ADS-B and using that technology on drones. There's been, you know, a number of proponents and opponents to the concept. Most of the criticism or desire to not equip ADS-B has to do with something called spectrum congestion. And so we've developed a concept to deal with that called low power, inert, and alert.
Explain how that works in operation.
Sure.
Sequence of events.
Sure. So the concern with spectrum congestion is that too many UAS transmitting in the airspace could potentially threaten the stability of the airspace system and cause targets to be lost or for the system to be unresponsive. So our response to that is two parts. One, low power, reducing the power output so that we're not transmitting 50 or 100 miles into the airspace, but only to a relevant radius of, say, 5 to 10 miles.
The biggest problem with the original spec is that it's a long distance, 30 watts, which you can't really get out of a drone and stay in the air more than about 3.5 seconds. And the fact that there's no need for an airliner at 30,000 feet to see all these specs below of stuff that has nothing to do with 30,000 feet.
Sure. So aside from the congestion issue, there's the screen clutter challenge, which is what you're talking about. It's too much information that I don't need to see that's not relevant to my aircraft's flight. So by lowering the power, we automatically limit that range to 5 to 10 miles. And of course, there's also selective filtering that can be employed by high-level or low-level aircraft to reduce the clutter.
One thing we need to explain is when you're talking about low power, that's not a constant output situation.
Correct. It's the duty cycle is very low. It's a momentary transmit.
2 per second, right?
No, ADS-B on the UAT frequency is actually once per second.
But it's at random intervals so that you can have 30 or 40 of them, and the chances of collision over 2 or 3 seconds, you'll get one through clear. That's the theory.
Yes, sort of. So UAT actually is time synchronized based off of the UTC tick. So there's the first so many milliseconds are for the FAA ground stations to transmit, and then the rest of the time after is designed to allow aircraft and vehicles to do their communications.
What do they do for signal collision then? Redundancy.
Yeah, that's actually a bit beyond my knowledge. So that would be a question for some of our regulatory folks. I apologize.
So does the picture look good, or does it look like it's a hard trek for avionics and others, or where are we going?
Well, so there are a number of solutions being proposed. There's the low power inert and alert, and then there's also talk of potentially additional spectrum being allocated, alternate frequencies for unmanned systems to use in an ADS-B-like traffic management.
That would not make sense, because the whole thing is to coordinate with manned aircraft and others like that. That seemed like everybody needs to be on the same page.
Yeah, it certainly does seem that way, and you know, I can't really address, or it's not in my purview to address. You know, this is just a solution that's being considered.
DJI is proprietary, and you've had some obstacles trying to integrate your product with theirs, and it's gone back and forth, and you were relating some adventures there we won't go into. But of all of the manufacturers out there, there are some that are compatible with, for example, the Ping that I have. What are those?
So, we found the most acceptance in the open source community with RG Pilot and Pixhawk. From an industry standpoint, they've been the most rapid adopters of traffic management technologies and advanced situational awareness.
So that takes care of the do-it-yourselfer. How about a main manufacturer? Is 3DR on the list?
So there are ways to integrate with, for instance, the 3DR Solo. For transmit only, we have solutions for almost every aircraft. The challenge with the receive chain is that in order to effectively receive an aircraft's position, it needs to pass through the flight controller or at least have access to the GPS. We have a published integration guide that's available on our website. Our protocols are open, and we'd like to see further adoption of something that we think is part of being a good participant in the national airspace system, and that's awareness of what's going on, you know, beyond the bubble.
The biggest obstacle for general aviation meeting the 2020 deadline for ADS-B is cost. And if, you know, right now UAVs are not in that, they're not required to, they're not in that picture, it would make, they seem to be a major missing piece of the puzzle. But so far as cost, where are we on that with ADS-B for drones?
Well, with ADS-B for drones, the challenge is the current specification lays out minimum performance requirements, and those requirements are designed for manned aircraft and higher transmit powers. So in low volumes, obviously, the cost is comparable to equipping a general aviation aircraft, because, again, we don't get to do a poorer job of transmitting in the airspace. We have to comply with all those rules. With a lower power option, we could make it extremely affordable.
From a receive-only side, what are the options and costs?
From a receive-only side, it just comes down to volume. I mean, we could build receivers and mass for manufacturers to adopt, probably, at similar silicon prices, maybe $10 per unit.
You showed me a very tiny, looked like almost a prototype. That is marvelous. Explain that.
Yeah, so the tiny UAT is a complete ADS-B transceiver about the size of a contact lens.
The biggest thing on it is the connector, and it's a tiny little mini four-pin.
Correct. The JST connector is larger than the rest of the device. And if I could go back to inert and alert, something that I didn't touch on was this transceiver would be designed to remain silent and just receive aircraft position reports. When an aircraft enters a specified threat radius, we could then transmit our position to that aircraft so they're aware.
But and alert the operator at the same time.
Correct, and alert the operator. And the concept there is that we mitigate all the spectrum concerns by only transmitting when there's a near-miss type situation occurring. The rest of the time, we're just in an alert state or an inert state, but listening or using the flight controller to be aware of what's happening around it.
It's unusual that the manufacturers are leading the way, because in many cases people come up with regulations like the 2020 deadline and ADS-B, and the manufacturers had to play catch up, starting with horrendous costs and then moving down. I admire avionics in that you're leading in the other direction, and you guys are showing the FAA and the rest of them where they really ought to be going.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the ADS-B mandate is that the mandate was actually created almost before there were any devices on the market. And so they created a demand for...
We got to explain, we're at Lakeland at Sun and Fun, and there are some planes in the neighborhood. We're outside one of the hangars, and the plane just went by. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the mandate was created before there were very many devices available on the market. And the general aviation volume is quite low compared to, say, you know, let's take the Bluetooth chip, for example. That chip is sold in the hundreds of millions worldwide, and so the silicon to accomplish it is, you know, sub-dollar price point in high quantities. The ADS-B, you know, analog to digital conversion, the RF involved there was no existing silicon, so all the solutions had to be designed from the ground up. You can't just go to, say, a DigiKey and order a 978 receive solution. So we had to engineer our own, as did most of the GA community. And again, you're talking about, in general aviation, you're talking about selling, you know, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 units. And you're talking about a significant and costly engineering effort to sell a few thousand units, which is why we see prices anywhere from $2,000 to $6,000 for a small aircraft. And for a commercial or business jet, I've heard quotes as high as $80,000 to meet this mandate.
But if ADS-B suddenly becomes necessary, and certainly I see that it would be necessary for beyond visual line of sight, which from my point of view is IFR for drones, and you know, the transponders and whatnot have got to be a part of that, because if you can't see it, you can't avoid it.
Correct.
And so to me, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I applaud avionics for getting out there ahead of the thing, and I think it's a wise investment of your energies, because if suddenly there is a mandate for several hundred thousand drones to be aware, I think you've got a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly are leaning forward in the concept of interoperation with the national airspace, and it's really the only way that we see, at least in the near term, to, you know, turn the key on the drone economy and really unlock what we're capable of. Because right now, the limitations that are placed on the flights are actually, you know, every day there's a new airframe, there's a new battery technology, there's some new capability that we have for these amazing vehicles, but we have no way to actually allow them to perform those services, because there's no way to interoperate with the existing airspace. So, that, you know, that's our position, and we just look forward to hopefully enabling and democratizing the sky.
Looking ahead, you guys are going to be in Texas Exponential?
Yes, we absolutely will be at Exponential. I mean, it's clearly the place that a lot of the industry looks to for innovation and forward movement in this what I call the drone economy or the drone age.
Anything to look forward to? Any expectation of announcements or anything at that event?
I expect we'll have some announcements there, some partnerships, and some things that we hope will cause the industry to take notice. We're a small company. We certainly don't have, you know, the communications and marketing efforts of some of the other airspace solution proponents. But ours is the only one that's been proven every day by general aviation and the integrity of our airspace.
Anybody going to Exponential this year, I recommend they do what I do, and that is any event that I go to, I scout out avionics, because it's always informational, educational, and informative. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Well, that was very interesting, David. This is an example of sort of an intersection between drones and general aviation, manned flight.
Definitely, it's an issue of cost. General aviation has been sort of intimidated by ADS-B because of the cost of the receivers, as well as the, you know, in drones, we have it's not only just the cost of the receivers, it's the weight of the receivers or transponders. Sounds like they've got some interesting solutions. I like the idea of a only respond when necessary kind of pinger that they were talking about, that small one that detects the other aircraft and should come to a threshold that responded back. That's kind of an interesting technology where you're minimizing the amount of data going back and forth, which minimizes the need for power and minimizes the need for size.
And of course, the drones have something that general aviation doesn't have, at least not to the same degree, which is volume. And just like how cell phones brought down the price of very tiny GPS receivers, drones offer an opportunity to reduce the costs of ADS-B equipment just because of the sheer volume of them. Now, of course, not every drone out there, and we've talked about this, but not every small drone out there needs ADS-B. But still, there are many, many that would require or could use that kind of technology in a positive way to manage the traffic. So that's great. So we want to thank Tim Trott. You can find him at thedroneprofessor.com. UAvionics is U, the letter U, AVIONX.com. And we'll have links to, of course, both of those in the show notes.
So I guess we should get to a little bit of news. Our first one is from Engadget. ESPN Drone Racing League returns with faster, bigger races. We've been following this along, and I think you're fond of Formula One. Things keep getting bigger, faster, and quicker. So ESPN is sort of promoting Drone Racing League, and they're going to use the Racer 3, which is a bigger drone.
Well, the drone itself is not really bigger. It's got more capabilities. It's faster. It's got more power. It's more agile. And so when they talk about bigger here, they're talking about bigger races, not so much bigger drones. But this Racer 3 is a fast little bugger. It goes from 0 to 80 in under a second. It's sort of festooned with LED lights, including a built-in LED matrix display. It's got a custom battery, 1,800 milliamps and 7,000 kilograms of static thrust. There's a quote in, I think, in the ESPN item on this, where they say these little tiny drones could actually lift a 25-pound bowling ball. I mean, these things are powerful and fast. But, you know, David, that's the thing. It's really hard to see something that moves really fast. And when you make it faster and you make it more agile and able to accelerate in ways that are just unbelievable and make turns that are just unbelievable, it makes spectating difficult. I'm still in the camp of hoping to see just really large drones, something that we can, you know, see from the stands, as it were.
Max is alluding to Reno 2027, where the first Predators and Reapers will be used for pylon racing.
Yeah, they won't be as fast as these drones, as this Racer 3, but, you know,
you'll be able to see them.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Max, to elude your thing is, I think that's why they're festooned, as you use the word, with LEDs.
Yes.
Things that blink and twinkle are easy to keep track of. And I know that a couple of times that I've seen drone racing on television, they use the LEDs as kind of like you would watch a NASCAR, you know. Mm. One's yellow, one's red, one's blue, one's green. So you can follow the team. You know, they're not covered yet with stickers for sponsors, but you can track them down by their colors, given the speed.
And I should correct myself. I see it's not a 25-pound bowling ball. It's only a 15-pound bowling ball. So I sort of overstated it, but it's.
Have you ever thrown a 25-pound bowling ball?
I don't think I've thrown a 15-pound bowling ball, let alone a 25-pounder. But so there's six races in this series. It's the 2017 Alliance World Championship First race starts in June 20th, 2017 on ESPN. You can also find these races on Sky Sports. And something that I'm not familiar with, ProSieben Max, which is...
ProSieben. That B should be a double S.
Oh, my German is so rusty. But it's a German channel. And of course, there's 16 pilots. They all use the same racer, the same Racer 3 drone.
I like that. You know, here, Max, you ready for this?
Mm.
My favorite old-time car races were IROC.
I remember those.
International Race of Champions. The cars were all specifically the same thing. You know, it was to prove who was the better driver. You eliminated the car, then you so. I kind of like the everybody has the same vehicle. Let's see how well you can drive it.
Yeah, it's great. And then you got to watch out for, you know, those who kind of skirt the intent of the rules and find ways to tweak their little. They're little racers in ways that others haven't.
You've been hanging around Formula One way too long.
Yeah, so let's move on to the FAA.
Yeah, they're in the quest for speed also, like the drone racers. Their quest is to speed up drone authorization applications. This was from themselves, the FAA.gov. The FAA wants to help drone operators improve the quality of their Part 107 airspace authorization requests. They also want to speed up the process. So they're working to set up some more plans and guides and release a set of Felicity. Why can't I say that word?
Facility.
Facility. Thank you. Wow. Okay. Maps to show to help people work on their 107s and to write better specs.
These are facility maps that show areas and altitudes near airports where you can operate your drone safely. And these will be available online starting April 27th, 2017 at the UAS website, faa.gov/UAS. And the idea is that as you're putting together your Part 107 authorization request, you can use these maps to describe your flights in ways so that it's more likely that when the FAA gets your application, they'll be able to look at it and say, okay, yep, you're compliant. That's a great thing. They also say that you'll be able to download this data, these facility maps, in several different formats. You'll be able to view the site on mobile devices, and you can even customize your views, so it'll be we'll be watching for just exactly what that means.
And I like to say that I'm very impressed with the FAA. They're trying to work with the drone operators to, A, improve their abilities as well as the drone operators' abilities. So they're working hand in hand. They're not, they want to be more timely. And if they can help people write the right specs so they're not having to send things back, that helps everybody in the long run. So good for the FAA.
Now, they're going to be releasing these maps in phases. The April 27 release is going to include about 200 of them, and they'll increase the number of them over the next 12 months. So there's sort of a phase-in period. The FAA took some pains to explain that these maps are informational only, and having the map, it doesn't automatically authorize flights. It also doesn't guarantee that your approval will be granted. So just that little caveat there. But as you say, David, this is great because they're finding ways that increase the quality of the applications. That's good for drone operators and for the speed of the process. And they're also using this to help the approval process in the FAA. They're, again, shortening the time required to approve an application.
So let's go to our next story. We talked about speed with the FAA on racing, and Max was complaining that he couldn't identify the racers because they were too small. Well, let's talk about the Border Patrol. They want facial recognition so they know who they're spying on or tracking. We'll use a more politically correct term. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection is soliciting proposals for small UAS to be used by U.S. Border Patrol agents in the field. And part of that is they want facial recognition, which is a technology I don't think we've really talked much about, though it seems to be coming into vogue. It's been around a little bit for a while in various places, but we're getting now more mainstream with it.
Although, you know, when I think of facial recognition software and applications, I think of viewing someone front on from the face, from a drone up in the air. I don't know. Is it facial recognition? Maybe it's hairline recognition or something. I don't know, David. But
it's personal attribute recognition. How's that?
That sounds good. They want to be able to distinguish between things like people, but also animals and vehicles. And they want to be able to use the recognition and the data that's collected or captured, let's say, in real time to connect with law enforcement databases so the agent in the field could actually make real-time decisions about what they're viewing. They want the drones to be of a size that can be carried in a truck, also that can be deployed by a single Border Patrol agent in under 5 minutes. They also talk about the desirability of having voice command capability for these drones. They're thinking about the situation where there's just one person, that Border Patrol agent doing all of this work with the drone, and having hands free, being able to issue commands by voice would be a really handy attribute. So it's kind of interesting. There are a few issues associated with this, though, that the those responding to the requests for a proposal have to work on.
One of those things that is data streaming and hacking. We're talking about the border where we don't have a lot of cell towers, and we don't want people who were trying to track with the drones to be able to hack the drones. I was thinking as I was reading this, thinking of Rogue One, where he releases the drones out of him to target for other people. And it's a flying body camera, sort of, where the drone is looking out and has a forward eyes. And it would be really good to record if there was an incident or something that could transmit data in real time back to a base. So you've got a body camera, but a flying one. So it's interesting. The companies have till April 27th to submit proposals.
And the Department of Homeland Security has been taking a kind of a different approach. And this started a few years ago, actually about 3 years ago in 2014, where they've started to act more like a venture capital company in terms of sort of seeding out funding to smaller companies to meet the requirements that they're after. You know, I think this is a different approach than sort of the traditional issue a big request for proposal, getting big corporations to respond with lengthy, expensive proposals. This is something that's trying to be more nimble, I think, than we've seen in the past. They want to get new technology into government fast, and this is one way they want to do it. And then the other interesting point is the predators that they had been using or have been using along the border. I guess we see that the fleet of 10 predator drones that they had been employing just really haven't been providing the results that they were hoping for. They've been more expensive to operate. They haven't been very effective. And back to your point, David, about hacking, the predators they found were subject to many, many attempts at spoofing and GPS jamming. So they're looking for a replacement system that uses smaller drones that are field deployable, aren't subject to these same problems.
Keep in mind that those Predator drones are actually Predator BREs, which are civilian versions of Reapers. They're the high-end ones. So it's kind of sad that we've invested that money and it's not working out. And part of it was, as when we had CPB on, was they didn't have enough pilots to operate them. So, you know, in this case, you're not building a fleet of aircraft where you're going to need pilots. You're going to build a fleet of drones that is going to be one more tool in a Border Patrol officer's toolbox.
Right.
You know, so that's changing the way you're viewing the mission, you know. So that's not only a technology change, but it's a thought change. It's a sea change. Mm. So it's very interesting. So, Max, we got a video of the week.
Yeah, we got this from our listener, Luke. And this is about one particular video, but also a YouTube channel, really. This video is called, Safety Drone, Check out the Tracker Drone. This is from the RC Sailors. That's S-A-Y-L-O-R-S. This particular video is about a drone that they did kind of a little review on. And it's kind of entertaining because they're out flying it in the backyard. And it turns out to be a great drone to keep your dog, the pet, occupied and energized as the dog kind of, once the drone catches the attention of the dog, I guess, the dog just has a terrific time with it. The RC Sailors has a YouTube channel, and they do reviews and unboxings, and it's about RC in general, but there's a lot of drone stuff in there as well. So that's another resource to check out. And then we'll make that our video of the week.
And Max, of course, we want to remind everybody that June's coming, June 19th and 21st, and the Ascend Conference and Expo in Portland, Oregon will be occurring. And you can learn more about that on our event page. But more importantly, the organizers have given us a discount code. You can get $50 off admission. And if they use the discount code, the UAV Digest. So check that out on our page. And anybody out on the West Coast, go check out the Ascend Conference. And of course, if you go and you use the discount code, take a few minutes and use your iPhone and record some interviews and send them to Max and I at feedback@theuavdigest.com. We'd love to hear your stories from conventions that Max and I can't get to. And I'm sure there's a lot of other people who can't make it also. So let's take advantage of it.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the UAV Digest. Again, we want to thank Tim Trott for capturing that interview from Sun and Fun. As always, you can find us on our homepage, theuavdigest.com, and we've got show notes for this episode, including lots of links to the companies and news stories that we mentioned, and you can find that at theuavdigest.com/190.
And of course, we're all over the social media spectrum. You can find us on Twitter at @UAVDigest. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UAVDigest. We'd love for you to join our Slack listener team, and there's two ways to do that. You can go to our website, uavdigest.com/team, or you can send us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com with your email address saying you want to join the team, and Max and I will turn around and send you an invite. Keep in mind that this is a closed group, and so it eliminates sort of the ads, and you're a little more free to talk about things. And we've had some really good conversations across all spectrums. You can leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. And, of course, you can find some swag at theuavbest.com or become a patron of the show at patreon.com. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
This episode was sponsored in part by Unmanned Systems and Solutions. 30 USAS technicians repair all types of drones in their 120,000-square-foot professional drone repair facility. USAS also offers full-service operations consulting and programs for commercial and government users. Visit unmannedsas.com/UAVDigest to learn more about how to get your drone repaired.